I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Cape Wind, the proposed wind farm for Nantucket Sound, never made it past the planning stages. Now wind farm developers are looking farther offshore to sites in federal waters. Just as the Bureau of Land Management leases federal lands for private and corporate use, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has begun evaluating applications for leases of federal waters for renewable energy projects. Vineyard Wind is one of several companies who've applied for permits to construct wind farms off the coast of Martha's Vineyard. Today we talk about where the Vineyard Wind project stands and some of the concerns fishermen, residents, and others have expressed about the project. Joining us in studio is Eric Stevens. He's Chief Development Officer at Vineyard Wind. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So for people not familiar with the project, describe the location and the size of this proposed project.
The turbines will be located over 30 miles from the mainland, from the Cape. About 14 miles or more from the Vineyard or Nantucket. The turbine area will be in between Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket, basically due south of both islands. So the turbine area will be largely invisible or barely visible, certainly invisible from the Cape. But the effects of the project, I think, will be felt in a really positive way on the Cape and islands. Out on the Vineyard, we'll be having our operations and maintenance facility, be employing 50 or so folks out there, you know, year-round, good paying jobs, helping to maintain the maritime heritage out there on the Vineyard. Here on the Cape, we will be bringing our cables to shore to bring the clean energy to the Massachusetts grid. And that will mean that there'll be revenue to the communities of Cape Cod, be it tax payments or through a host community agreement payments. So that revenue, you know, that's for the towns to decide how they might use it, be it to reduce their property taxes or for infrastructure improvements that that they might not be able to fund otherwise. And of course, in New Bedford, we'll be staging the construction of the project, and there will be hundreds of jobs to actually build the project.
Yeah. So what is it about this area that makes it suitable for wind development?
Well, it's windy, as we've seen recently, especially. So the one thing that's really different, you mentioned an earlier project, and one thing that's really different about our project is we actually didn't select the site area. It was selected basically for us, for the industry, by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. Through a stakeholder process involving environmental groups, but also local government, tribal government, state agencies, federal agencies, literally coming around the table, looking at a map, looking at the entire area offshore Massachusetts that could have offshore wind, and winnowing it down, eliminating areas for a number of reasons, whether it's because it was heavily fished or because of sensitive habitat of one sort or another. And that's why they eventually arrived at the area that's there now, and that a part of which we will be using for our project.
And it's always more complicated than it seems. So explain the process that Vineyard Wind has gone through so far in terms of obtaining lease rights and the difference between leasing rights and permitting rights. It's complicated, right?
Yeah, it is. So in a sense, this project actually began back in 2010. When the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management actually didn't exist in its current name, and there was no laws that really spoke to offshore wind, to offshore oil and gas, yes, but not to offshore wind. And so in some ways, it's been a learning process for all of us. So it only enhances that complication you mentioned. But back in 2010, we took a look at the situation and realized that there were really some strong fundamentals with why offshore wind was the right thing for Massachusetts. Has a high load area, big population close to the shore. Massachusetts as a state is committed to addressing climate change, and it's at the end of the energy pipeline, no matter, you know, literally and figuratively, no matter how you look at it, you have to somehow either import energy or use the energy that's here in New England, and that really comes down to basically wind. So we started looking at, if it's not going to be, Cape Wind, where else were our good areas? How do we go about finding a better location? How do we work with people who have been adversaries up until now and see if we can do it a different way. So we hired the first fisheries representative in the U.S. offshore wind industry. We had the first host community agreement with a nonprofit cooperative out on Martha's Vineyard starting back in 2010. And we worked with them since that time. In parallel to our efforts, the laws were changed and the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management was established. And they started this task force process that I described earlier, bringing together all these stakeholders, literally looking at the map and eliminating areas. They developed what they call a wind energy area, which is a large area that they found suitable for offshore wind. And then they divided that area into lease areas. And then they leased those areas off, basically a cash on the barrel head kind of auction. And we participated in that auction and won one of the lease areas, which is where our project is proposed for now. And so that gives us the right to do offshore wind there. It doesn't give us any other rights. It just gives us the right to do offshore wind. And now we are in the midst of our permitting process. Mm-hmm. And that is that will take about 18 months or so. There's some 30 agencies that we will have to have review our project, consent or permit our project. Again, tribal, local, state, and federal agencies will all be reviewing our project. And that's what we just started in the last couple months.
There are two other companies also vying to build offshore wind farms. Are their proposals similar in location and size to yours?
Yes, they are to the west of us.
As we mentioned, the Federal Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is responsible for handling leases and permits for offshore energy projects. Our invitation for them to join the program today was declined by the Bureau, but we hope to get them on in a future program. We are glad that Dr. Jim Miller can join us. He's a professor of ocean engineering at the University of Rhode Island, studying the underwater noise created by the construction and operation of wind turbines. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Mindy. I appreciate it.
Sure. Jim, you and colleagues from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution have been collecting acoustic data from the wind turbines operating off the coast of Block Island. Tell us more about objectives of your research and how it was commissioned.
Sure. So this work is sponsored by BOEM, Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, also under a program called RODEO, which has an acronym I can't remember. But basically, it's there to take advantage of the construction and to learn how the construction and operation of a wind farm would affect marine life, including marine mammals and fish and turtles. And so they funded a group including Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, the University of Rhode Island, and a company called Marine Acoustics, Inc., and another company in the U.K. called Subacoustic to go out and deploy equipment during construction and some of the same equipment during operations to try to assess effects. And we weren't part of the team that was doing that the developer hired. We were hired by the federal government.
So what's the construction process that generates the most underwater sound, and just how loud is it?
So technology that was used by the developer Deepwater Wind was called lattice jacket structures. These are basically, think of them as four-legged tables, and the legs are being driven into the seabed, you know, pretty deeply because they've got to be able to withstand nor'easters like yesterday and hurricanes in the summer and fall. So these the installation of these piles driven into the seabed is the by far the most intense. They basically have to take a big hammer and drive the, like driving a nail into a piece of wood, and so it might take hundreds or a thousand whacks on this cable, and that sound does radiate into the environment. Over probably 20, 25 days spread around 2015, fall, summer and fall of 2015, these five 30-megawatt wind turbines were installed 5 miles south of Block Island. It's the first offshore wind farm in the United States, so BOEM wanted to take advantage of this to try to learn more about what's the best practices for monitoring and things like that.
Yeah. So how far does this noise travel underwater? Do we know?
Yes, that is a great question. We had equipment as close as 500 meters from some of the construction and as far out as 15 kilometers. And we are trying to predict how far the pile driving sound goes out. And we're actually, YT Lin at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution has some 3D acoustic models. It's basically trying to understand the effect of the oceanography and geology on how sound propagates a long way. And we're still working on that, still trying to calibrate our models and things like that.
Is there any previous research studying how this type of noise impacts marine mammals and fish?
Yes. Well, the Europeans have lots of experience. They've put in thousands of many hundreds of wind turbines. And so we have, their experience and their papers. And we, in fact, the pile driving signals that we measured, the levels were just about where we thought they should be. So the surprise, there were a number of surprises in the program, but the pile driving levels, at least close in, were not surprising. They were just about where we had expected them to be.
So if fish and marine mammals are driven away by high levels of noise, do we know how long it takes them to return once the noise stops?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know the answer to the question, but I do know that there were fin whales in the area during construction, and then 5 days after construction ended, we had a fin whale swim through our area, come within 500 meters of our equipment, just bellowing very low-frequency sound. In fact, it was amazing. We're going to get a PhD student dissertation out of it for my student. And we heard that animal for, 18, 24 hours, just bellowing and coming sort of far away, coming by, and then going away. So I don't know that's a very difficult question, but I do know that right away there was an animal. Maybe he was coming, he was curious about what the noise, I don't know.
Yeah, checking it out, right.
So yeah, checking it out, what's going on?
Yeah, what's going on over there?
It is amazing. And he about every 9 or 10 seconds, he'd let off this bellow, and that would go on for hours. And every 20 minutes or so, he'd stop. And Mark Baumgartner and I at HUI I've been asking him questions. He's a biologist, why does he do that? And he's trying to teach me some biology. I'm an engineer, so I...
So, Eric, in the construction phase of Vineyard Wind, if it's approved, will the turbines be erected one at a time? Will there be multiple towers erected simultaneously? I'm wondering about the cumulative impacts of that sound that's being considered.
Right. No, that's an excellent question. So we are... To answer your first question, they are installed serially, so one after another. We start with the foundations. In our case, we'll most likely be using what are called monopiles, basically, as the name suggests, basically like a large piling, steel tube that's driven, a single steel tube that's driven into the ground, as opposed to the lattice that was used in Block Island. So we will be installing those one after the other. It takes about a day to install them. We will be doing that during the time of year when the right whale in particular is not generally.
That's going to be my next
area.
Question. Yeah. You're reading my mind. Yeah. Yeah.
And as far as the it's interesting to hear that the acoustic models that were used in Block Island seem to have proved out, because we'll be using, they might even literally be the same model or similar model. We are using them to model the acoustic effect of that pile driving of our project on our lease area. It is different, even though the Block Island project is not far away. The soil conditions are different, the water depths are different. All of these things change how the sound propagates. So we are doing our own particular modeling for our area, we can say, okay, we don't expect to have a type of impact on particular species at X distance out, and then we'll be able to have monitors to ensure that there are no species of whatever type is of concern within that area before
we start
the pilot driving.
So you'll be looking for that then? You'll be looking to see if there are marine mammals
during
the construction phase?
We'll have observers, yep.
And then if one is spotted, what do?
We have to wait till they're
gone. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to chime in this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about offshore wind, specifically Vineyard Wind, one of several companies who've applied for permits to construct wind farms off the coast of Martha's Vineyard. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. In studio is Eric Stevens, Chief Development Officer at Vineyard Wind. And on the phone, Jim Miller. He's a professor of ocean engineering at the University of Rhode Island, studying the underwater noise created by construction and operation of wind turbines. So, Jim, fish and marine mammals communicate at different frequencies. Did your research collect noise across frequencies?
Yes. Well, yeah, exactly. We concentrated our efforts on measuring sound below 5 kilohertz. And we did that because that was where we expected the most significant noise from construction and also from operation. Animals can communicate, you know, dolphins are up at 100 kilohertz, echolocating and communicating in the tens of kilohertz. We did have some equipment out there at those high frequencies, but most of our effort was down where the construction noise was mm-hmm. centered.
Yeah. And do we know how the noise at different frequencies impacts the fish and marine mammals?
Wow. That is a topic of great discussion across the community, the marine biology community, the ocean engineering community. National Marine Fisheries Service is responsible for, Marine Mammal Protection Act and the legal side of protecting marine mammals, and they've put out guidance recently on injury levels at which you want to stay below so that marine mammals aren't injured. That was based on a paper by Brandon Southall and a number of people. I was also a co-author on that paper. And so part of that was giving the levels and also the frequency bands that the animals end up hearing in. So the mysticetes, the baleen whales, have a low frequency. It's like when you have an air noise, you have DBA. What does DBA mean? It means it's A-weighted, which is it's weighted by the human hearing curve. And so there's levels now set that are weighted by what the biologists think are the mysticete hearing curves, the dolphin hearing curves, the seal and sea lion hearing curves. They're all different. It's a very sophisticated set of mm-hmm. Criteria that is being used for the planning of these types of developments and other ocean noise sources.
Yeah. I imagine seasonality plays a factor in how fast the turbines spin, what fish and marine mammals are in the waters, and do we have more noise the faster they turn? And did your studies factor in seasonality?
So as far as I understand, these wind turbines are direct drive. They're, and there's no gearbox. And so they try to run these at a constant speed, as I understand. We have, by the way, in operations, the noise is extremely low. It's barely detectable. If a ship or a fishing boat comes by or the wind comes up, we can't hear the wind turbines. And we're still trying to understand exactly where on the wind turbine the noise that we can measure comes from. So the seasonal effects we expected, because summertime you get warm water at the top and cold at the bottom. In the winter, it's all mixed because of the wind, and it's all. And we haven't been seeing, and we've had measurements out there in the two of the seasons, in winter and in late summer, early fall. And the effect doesn't seem to be as much as we thought. It might be because the levels are so low that, we had to be within 50. We had to be underneath the wind turbine to hear it. Mm. So when it's operating, there's very little noise, barely detectable noise. And If a fishing boat comes by, you don't hear it until the fishing boat leaves.
Jim Miller is professor of ocean engineering at the University of Rhode Island, who's been studying the noise created from the construction and operation of offshore wind turbines. Fascinating research. Jim, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Joining us from her office in Scituate is Beth Cassone. She's executive director of the Massachusetts Lobstermen's Association. Welcome, Beth.
Well, thank you for having me. Good morning. How are you doing with all this lovely weather we've been having?
Yeah, it's not as bad here on the Cape, I guess, as it is off Cape. But Beth, fishermen of all kinds have expressed concerns about the development of offshore wind farms. So what are the concerns?
Well, we've been following offshore wind since its inception 15 years ago when they developed the lease areas. And the fishermen have been, you know, very vocal and at the table since then. And some of the biggest concerns they have is with the siting of the turbines and the layout format for transmission
lines. Yeah.
Yeah. When they leave port and head out to sea, and you know, one of the biggest concerns was the radar scatter. And you know, I've seen some radar from the Block Island wind turbines, and the fishermen, you know, have the ability to fine-tune or expand their reception, will you, on their radar. So everyone's ability is a little different depending on the vessel that we're talking about. So the mobile gear fleet has a little bit more ability to fine-tune radar, but I've seen, you know, concerns with the electromagnetic fields. The fishing industry is very concerned about that because there's a lot of unknown here in the United States. While there's some research being done by URI on EMF, and the species that are being looked at aren't all the species that are being harvested within the lease areas, and it leaves great concern when these cables are going to be laid down. You know, it's one thing to look at a cable in a laboratory setting, and then you take it out and you put it into full-scale operation. And some of these lease areas are proposing 800 megawatts, and you know, currently Deepwater Wind's developing a 90 megawatt project, and that's about 13 to 15 turbines. And if you're looking at 800 megawatts, you know, do the math real quick, that's you know, you're talking about a couple hundred turbines, and that's a lot of cables under the water that we don't know what the impacts are going to be. Mm. So the fishing industry has been very clear in saying that we want to make sure that research is done well before, and we're not talking 1 year, 2 years, you know, 5 years, 6 years of studies that are done before anything is laid down on the seafloor, because the unfortunate thing is we'll never know until it's too late, and we can't undo the damage 10 years after these are up because there's so much money invested by the developers.
Yeah, Beth, offshore wind farms have been in operation for a number of years in other countries. What can we learn from them about the impact on fisheries?
We've talked with a few fishermen that have come over from the UK to meet with us years ago, and I've talked with one of their fisheries liaison who's been involved for years. You know, every fishery is a little bit different, and we can't lump sum them all into saying fisheries because there's mobile gear fleets, there's recreational fleets, there's fixed gear fleets, and everyone's needs are a little different. And the UK has a different bottom, there's a different ecosystem, so it's really hard to compare the two. While some fisheries might be okay, we don't know because there's not the full scale comparisons. It's basically apples and oranges. Technology, one thing that I'm looking at is the technology and the development of the turbines has advanced greatly over the past 25 years. So the amount of wind turbines in the UK, Scotland area could be reduced if they were being installed today by the size of them. So the higher they are, the fewer you need. So looking at what was done in the development overseas, might have been a lot less turbines in the water, if you're following me there.
Yeah. So for development, offshore wind farms have to meet state and federal guidelines. And as they are written now, do those guidelines call for the kind of impact research that you think is needed?
They call for it, but I think it's not as clear on where and what research is done and on what species. Because if you put them in economic value, the impacts from A to Z, I know that, and I'll just speak because we're meeting with Vineyard Wind next week, and all the developers have been open and forefront with our organization, and you know, we have a direct line of communication with their fisheries representatives and their fisheries liaisons, which is great. So they're listening, but it's what they do with that information to come back to the industries that are raising these concerns. And in Vineyard Sound, there's a significant conch fishery, and conch is our beloved snail. And we have a lot of lobstermen that conch fish because their boats are set up for it. So conch is not even on the radar. And while they're slow moving, they might not be so quick to get out of the way. And also, we don't know what the impacts are going to be when all this sediment is in the water and the impacts of the electromagnetic fields on the conch fishery in the sound are real. So that's something we're going to be talking with Vineyard Wind next week when we meet with them down the Cape.
Yeah. All right, Eric, so this is not new. You're not, none of this is new to you. So go ahead, let's hear.
Eric,
Eric's here. Yeah, he's here.
Hi, Beth. How are you?
Oh, hey, Eric. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you? I didn't know you were in the studio.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts, Eric, as you're listening to Beth's concerns?
Well, a few thoughts. One is she's absolutely right about the there is no such thing as a fishery or a fishing industry. There are different gear types, different working out of different ports, obviously looking for different species and so on, and that honestly presents a challenge to us because there is. You literally cannot make everybody happy. So a big part of what we're trying to do is find solutions to these different issues that that work for the most people as possible. For example, Beth mentioned transit through the turbine area, and that's actually something we heard very early on. As I mentioned back in 2010, when we first started thinking about a project out in that area. The scallop fleet comes out of New Bedford and goes around No Man's and heads out to their fishing area, transiting across our area. And so we aligned our turbines so that boats doing that transit would have a straight shot through. And we actually even spaced sort of a corridor where the turbines were. A full mile apart, full nautical mile apart. They're usually about 8/10 of a mile apart, and so then that seemed like a good solution. It turns out that there are others that fish in that area that would rather go east to west versus sort of northeast to southeast. So now we're looking at, is it possible to align the turbines so that it can accommodate both of those? So then the other thing I would add is. Mindy, you mentioned experience in Europe, and there is a lot of it. But while offshore wind is new here in the U.S., we actually have five high voltage transmission lines going under Nantucket Sound right now. Three serve Martha's Vineyard, and two serve Nantucket, and one of them lands in Kalmus Beach in Barnstable. I haven't met someone yet who's said that it had created a problem with them for fishing. One of the first cables out on the vineyard to the vineyard. It was an early technology. It did come up on the surface. I mean, they're all buried. I guess I did hear of an earlier one. To be fair, that caused problems from time to time. But it seems like the technology's improved. They know how to bury the cables deeply now. So we do have experience with these high voltage transmission lines underwater here, right here in Nantucket and the vineyard.
Beth, it's not inconceivable that offshore oil and gas exploration could be proposed off the coast of Massachusetts. What would have to change at both the state and federal level to require more impact data research on both renewable energy and oil and gas exploration projects?
Well, I'd like to say collectively, we hope that never happens. And if it does, it's a contradiction of what's being done in southern New England. So why are we, going through all the undue stresses to develop renewables when they're going to go start drilling? So we're very actively involved in that. The research that would have to be done would be comparable to what is being looked at in the southern New England wind lease areas. we're really hopeful. We did participate at the BOEM, Bureau of Ocean and Energy Management, meeting. It was supposed to be a public hearing, and it got changed to a meeting. But we know that we're aligned with the environmental groups on this one, and we're hoping that we don't have to have those discussions. And I just want to touch on something Eric said. And, you know, when we meet next week, I'd really like to see the more information we can see on what is in the water for cables and what is running through them, the better. Because as an organization, we like to make sure our members and the industry is informed. And because there's just so much information coming at the fishermen, mm-hmm. and we want to make sure that what we're saying and doing is, you know, conducive to what is there. So if there are high voltage cables, are they AC, are they DC, how deep are they buried, what, you know, what are the impacts, if any, are known? That this is information that would be great. You know, one or two cables coming ashore, you know, we're concerned with the magnitude of having three developers with multiple projects. You know, mm-hmm. that's one thing that I try to convey to the industry is it's going to take time to develop these lease areas into its entirety. Mm-hmm. And we have two more lease areas that are going up for bid this year. So we'll have five developers with multiple projects. So we're just trying to be ahead of the curve. And I know Eric and the other industry reps and, you know, you guys are doing a great job, and, you know how to get a hold of us if you have any questions. So,
okay. Beth Cassoni is the executive director of the Massachusetts Lobstermen's Association. Beth, thanks so much for joining us this
morning. Thank you so much. Take care. Yeah. Bye-bye.
We have an email from Tom who says, here in Provincetown, it seems the wind hasn't abated since October. And this week, oh my, of course, in the summer, it's not as strong, but nearly as persistent. Wind power is the logical move forward for our region. But it also seems vineyard wind will contribute to the economy of the Cape and Islands. Can you discuss the economic benefits of having a local company take the lead as energy generation is transformed? You sort of touched on that a little bit earlier.
Right. Well, it's take the lead, I think, is a key thought there, because there are two other developers advancing projects. I think it's fair to say ours is the furthest along in that long process that we discussed earlier for permitting. We're the only developer who have submitted our federal and state permit applications at this point. And what that means is, no matter how long it takes, in the end, we'll be the first project to start through that process, and that means we'll be the first commercial scale project in the U.S. And what that means, getting back to the economy, is that it'll center the new offshore wind industry here in the U.S. here in Southeast Massachusetts, and really make this part of the world the hub of an new industry for certainly for the East Coast, if not the U.S. And we're also doing a few things to sort of leverage or expand off of that first mover advantage, to use a little bit of a cliche. One of them is what we're calling the Offshore Wind Accelerator. This is a commitment, if we're selected to do this project, to a $10 million fund to help existing businesses in the area get into the offshore wind industry, to expand facilities and infrastructure that would support the industry going forward. And we're asking to do this on a cost share basis, or a dollar for dollar kind of basis, say. And we do that so that the other agencies and other businesses are investing alongside with us in building this industry. And we're also doing a $2 million Windward Workforce Fund. And what this is funding for training and career development, so that as this first project goes through the process and goes to construction, the people here in the region get the training they need to be the ones working on the project. And even if they don't work on our first project, they'll have had that training to work on the next one. Because as Beth said, this, you know, ours, you know, will likely be the first, but hopefully for everybody's sake, it will be one of many. Mm. And, you know, Beth's absolutely right about this. We need to think about the long-term sort of larger scale of it, which is a good thing in terms of creating an industry. You have a sustainable, competitive environment going on, multiple businesses getting into it. So lots of opportunity for the region, for sure.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about offshore wind, specifically the Vineyard Wind Project, with Eric Stevens, Chief Development Officer at Vineyard Wind. Joyce is giving us a call from Yarmouth. Good morning, Joyce.
Good morning, Mindy. Good morning, everyone. I just wanted to express my support for Vineyard Wind. They're the obvious environmental pluses of having our electricity come from renewable and local sources. But there are also economic and financial benefits, which you've just been discussing, and, of course, the educational programs that will be expanded at the Four Seas. I know that people who live near the water are concerned about the construction phase, but disruption to the bay and the offshore waters is only temporary, and it seems to me that the benefits are so long-term that the temporary construction and temporary inconvenience seems very workaroundable to me. Yeah. I hope this project succeeds.
All right. Joyce, thanks for your thoughts. And that's a perfect segue into where we're going. Residents of several Cape towns have raised concerns about the environmental impacts of the transmission lines that will bring the power from the wind farm ashore. And joining us to talk about some of the shore side concerns is Andrew Gottlieb. He's the executive director of the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. Welcome back.
Good to be back. Thanks.
All right. So before we talk about some of the specific coastal and shoreside concerns about Vineyard Wind, Eric, describe the route the power will take from the turbines to shore and give us a sense of the size of those transmission lines.
So we will have either two or three cables coming from our turbine array area south of the Vineyard in Nantucket. They will take a route through Muskeget Channel, the channel between the two islands, and go basically more or less straight to either Yarmouth or Barnstable, specifically either going into Lewis Bay and then to New Hampshire Ave in Yarmouth or to Covell's Beach in Barnstable. And I just want to I say more or less a straight line. If you looked at it, you'd say, what is he talking about? It's all squiggly. And the reason for that is we would like it to be a straight line, but we are avoiding sensitive habitat in some cases that the state has mapped as being areas to avoid for these kind of things. We're also avoiding shallower waters. There actually is it is a shoal area and areas out there. And we're avoiding areas to the extent we can where there's a lot of what's called sand waste, basically sand dunes, underwater sand dunes. So it does weave as it gets to the Cape. And then it comes ashore, and as I said, either New Hampshire Ave or as an alternative, Covell's Beach in Barnstable. And then the cable would be buried its entire length once it's on shore, mostly under streets in the towns, and then go to an existing substation in Barnstable.
All right. So, Andrew, what are some of the environmental concerns that residents and town officials have expressed?
Well, that's a variety of issues, and it obviously has an impact on your proximity to those areas, the nature of the concerns. From APCC's perspective, and we've talked to Tony about this, the issues, the short-term disruptions in water quality potentially in Lewis Bay are of a concern. I think they can be managed. We've talked a little bit about ways that the company might provide some support for some ongoing water quality initiatives that the town needs to undertake in order to restore habitat from nitrogen impacts. So there's a potential there for some opportunities for long-term benefit, mitigating the short-term disruptions. Obviously, wherever the cable comes onto the shore, there's what would almost look like a more conventional utility construction disruption that would go on. And depending on which location they choose, some of those issues are somewhat variable. The Lewis Bay project as a landing, as we understand it, will be more of a conventional trenching type approach, and then it'll go underground, just landward of the shoreline. And so those raise certain issues about short-term mitigation of impacts. The other possible landing sites might have the benefit, if you will, from a resource disruption perspective of being, rather than trenched, would be directionally drilled. So you could get away from some of the shoreline and nearshore impacts and pull the cable further inland. So I think those are all manageable engineering conversations that can take place. Once the cable's on land, then we've advised that from our association's perspective, the extent to which the cable can travel on existing streets and rights of way makes the most sense, and to try to minimize the route as it might potentially impact conservation lands, Article 97 lands, water supply protection lands. But again, those are engineering conversations, all of which we feel like can be managed. There are some trade-offs, as we understand it, between the sites that they're under consideration in terms of the miles of cable that need to be laid, the degree to which residential neighborhoods are impacted more by one route versus another route, and those are trade-offs that are very specific to the individuals involved.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have a comment or a question. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Now, we know our coastal ecosystem is fragile, and many bays and estuaries and wetlands are struggling, as you've mentioned, with nitrogen loading and development. Is the construction of the transmission lines through coastal ecosystems likely to degrade them any more than they are? Or as you're saying, is this something that we can overcome?
I think my feeling is that most of the impacts are going to be short-term in nature from the construction. And that in the larger scheme of things, the greater threats to ecosystems and water quality are two. One is the ongoing threat that we have from nitrogen contamination that we are generating on the land side that we need to manage individually on a town-by-town basis. Left unabated, that's going to have a bigger impact. And then secondly, as we saw this past weekend with the storm, we're on the receiving end on Cape Cod of great impacts from climate change. We're seeing increased storm frequency. We're seeing increased storm intensity. And if you lived along the coastal areas, you felt those things in a very real and tangible way. And I think that some of the changes that are happening to our marine environment as a result of unabated climate change that renewable energy begins to address are perhaps more severe and less controllable than the management around the impacts of one particular project or another.
Yeah. All right, Eric, what about that? We're expecting, stronger and more frequent wind events. How are these proposed turbines rated for hurricanes and strong wind events? And if one were to topple, what are the environmental impacts there?
They are designed to withstand typically what they call a 100-year storm or 100-year wave. That is, what is the maximum the strength of a storm or height of a wave that you would see if you were measuring over 100 years. Obviously, we don't actually measure for 100 years, but engineers have ways of measuring and doing samples to be able to tell us what that is, and then they're designed for that.
Yeah. Angela's giving us a call from West Yarmouth. Good morning, Angela.
Good morning. I have a question.
Sure.
I know that, and I've been to a number of the meetings, one of the possible routes was under consideration is Great Island, which is a relatively direct route. It avoids Lewis Bay altogether. I believe it's still on the table, and I'd like you to address why that might not be a preferable site to land.
Okay. Eric?
Great. Yeah, so this is another example where There's always trade-offs to everything, and what's preferable for one group might have impacts or issues from another perspective. So landing at Great Island would avoid going into Lewis Bay, but it would mean landing at a beach that's in a fairly natural situation, and there is We understand we have to study more, but there could be eelgrass off of that beach, eelgrass beds that are considered sensitive habitat that we'd want to avoid. You can avoid it using this directional drilling that Andy mentioned, but whether we can avoid all of it or not, like I said, we need to study yet. And so it's one of these situations where, you know, you have to weigh the relative impacts. You look at a natural beach like it's on Great Island versus New Hampshire Ave, where the asphalt literally ends at the water's edge. It's a question of weighing what are the impacts of each, and what can you do to mitigate the impacts of each.
All right. Thanks for the call, Angela. Jim is calling from Nantucket. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Mindy.
Hi.
I've got a question for you.
Sure.
How come you don't land the wires coming in from the field, either on Nantucket or on the Vineyard, where we already have cables that already go to the mainland? And you wouldn't have to go all the way across the Sound and dig up the over in Hyannis.
Yeah, we actually took
a... Plus, it would mitigate us from having to put in a third cable.
Yeah, good question, Jim.
Yeah, we actually spent a lot of time and not a little bit of money looking at that. The issue is that the existing cables going out to the Vineyard in Nantucket are not strong enough, big enough to take the full amount of power that our project would be generating. We'd be generating enough energy for over 400,000 homes. Obviously bigger than either. And so we would have to be installing new cables from the islands anyway. So getting back to the relative trade-offs, yes, you might avoid, say, going through Muskeget Channel, but you would be having two more cable landings onto a beach, one to get on to Nantucket or the Vineyard, and then another one to get off to go. Right. And then you'd still have the issue of where do you bring the cable to the mainland? Because like I said, the existing ones just aren't big enough for strong.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Chuck is calling from New Bedford. Hi, Chuck.
Hello. Well, I'm just wondering, when I looked at the Cape Wind project for a while, it was going on here in this Vineyard Wind, but most of the Vineyard Winds has an embedded address and a Vineyard name, but it's actually being hosted by international companies from Copenhagen. I'm wondering why we haven't developed a regional power authority with Cape and Martha's Vineyard based, so that the local personnel don't benefit the most. They're kind of like talking municipal power or something like that. It seems to me that the sailors that fought off the blast project were a problem, and it's like the mindset of the whole area hasn't really looked at how to best benefit themselves.
Right. Let me him chime in because we only have about a minute left. Go ahead, Eric.
The question of a power authority is beyond us as a private developer. I think it's a great idea. Personally. To the extent that existing law does allow for towns, municipalities to come together and aggregate their purchasing power, actually the Cape and Islands are a leader in the Commonwealth in that front with the Cape Light Compact, and we know them. We're in conversation with them, and we'll see where that goes, but it's a good point.
And we have Marilyn sent in an email, and she's suggesting bubble curtains that can dampen offshore energy sound for whales. Have you ever heard of that before?
Oh yes, we actually have a fair amount of experience with them in Germany, and we're definitely looking at using them here. Yep.
We're gonna have links with more information about the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management and offshore wind farm permitting, acoustic studies at the Block Island Wind Farm, the Association to Preserve Cape Cod and Vineyard Wind, including a map of the proposed wind farm location and transmission lines. That'll all be at our website, capeandislands.org. Andrew Gottlieb, Executive Director of the Association to Preserve Cape Cod, and Eric Stevens from Vineyard Wind. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you very much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.